Today is Wednesday, April 5th. We're going to be working on more brain information from chapters 12 and 13.
Okay, so cerebrospinal fluid is formed in a knot of capillaries, and there are several sets of these within your brain. These capillaries are called a choroid plexus. And the way we make cerebrospinal fluid is we take the plasma, the liquid portion of the blood, and we squeeze it across the wall of the capillaries. So plasma is mostly water, it's electrolytes, it's glucose and oxygen. This sounds like good stuff for your brain, right? So we're filtering out the nourishing stuff for your brain, and we're gonna put it in circulation in a clear, colorless fluid that we call cerebrospinal fluid. Now, we're not gonna filter out the blood cells. They're gonna stay in the bloodstream and continue to circulate throughout your capillaries and vessels inside your brain. But this cerebrospinal fluid, think of it as a nurturing fluid that's going to transport some good stuff to your brain tissue. All right, so what type of neuroglial cell helps to put into circulation that CSF?
The epithelium.
Good, that's right, ependymal cells, good. And what special feature do they have that circulates that CSF?
Cilia,
good. So even if you're laying completely motionless, those cilia can still create a current and make that cerebrospinal fluid circulate around your brain and spinal cord. So when we think about those choroid plexuses, they are found in several locations. One of them is down here by your fourth ventricle. We've also got a couple of sets here inside of your lateral ventricles. Those are the ventricles that curl like horns into each hemisphere of our cerebrum. I'm just gonna pick a starting point, and I picked your lateral ventricles as a good place to start. And I think this picture, let me go back here, is probably one of the better ones to use because it gives you the flow pattern from top to bottom on that left picture. So let's start with the flow pathway. We're gonna start with choroid plexus as the place where cerebrospinal fluid is formed. All right, from there we travel through these lateral ventricles. They kind of curl like horns in each hemisphere of our brain. Okay, so choroid plexus is where we form the cerebrospinal fluid. We circulate throughout the two lateral ventricles, and we go through an opening between the hemispheres here called the interventricular foramen. Some older textbooks call it the foramen of Monroe, but we're trying to move away from naming stuff after people because it doesn't really give you a descriptive of where it's located. So interventricular foramen says we're between the two ventricles that coil into the two sides of your brain. Where do we go next after that foramen?
Third ventricle.
Third ventricle, good. Where is it located?
At the end of the lateral.
Yeah, kind of at the end of the laterals, between the two hemispheres. And then we travel down a very narrow passageway called the cerebral aqueduct. From there, you'll notice that we expand into a rather large area that's called the fourth ventricle right there, and it's shaped like a baseball diamond. Now, where do we go after the fourth ventricle? Good. Inside what organ is the central canal?
Spinal cord.
Spinal cord, good. We travel all the way down to around L1 or L2 of the spinal cord. That's where the spinal cord terminates. And at what point, or rather now, we go outside the spinal cord and travel in the subarachnoid space. So where do we go after that? Good, go all the way back up to the brain, go back to these little arachnoid villi or granulations, and that's where we reabsorb the now dirty cerebrospinal fluid back into the bloodstream. Those vessels that lay around the outside surface of your brain are called sinuses, and because they lay in the folds of dura mater, they're called dural sinuses. So can you tell me the name of the one that lays in your longitudinal fissure? SSS is what it's good. Superior sagittal sinus, good. And the one that lays between cerebrum and cerebellum at the back?
Transverse,
good. So we get reabsorbed into one of those dural sinuses. They lay in the folds of that dura mater, and thus we just generally call them dural sinuses, just to kind of catch all those big blue veins around the brain. Now from there, that stuff goes back through the bloodstream, it gets cleaned by the kidneys, we get rid of the waste products, and then we can start all over again with fresh, clean, nutrient-rich cerebrospinal fluid that we give to the brain. So what is the advantage of doing this? Why not just let the brain nourish all that, or blood rather, nourish all that brain tissue?
Because
good. Keeps toxins and other bad stuff like bacteria and viruses from the brain tissue. But there's a disadvantage of this. What's the bad thing about the way the circulation works?
Some
medicines can't reach the brain, right? So we have to kind of trick the brain into letting certain medications across that barrier because we're not able to get everything to the brain through the cerebrospinal fluid. So the good and the bad, of course, comes with this circulation pattern. Okay.
Do you have to know, you gotta look at a picture and know where it goes, or is it just know the words?
No, the words, I think in lab you'll probably be covered on all those ventricles going the wrong way. So we'll do the anatomy part in lab, and then we'll do the flow path in both lab and lecture. How about other questions on CSF flow? Okay, so that takes us through page 111. Let's go ahead and flip over to page 112. Oh, let me make sure I do cover that blood-brain barrier stuff. I kind of glanced over it, but let me make sure I hit that fully for you on the bottom of page 111. Okay, so the reason we have that cerebrospinal fluid in circulation is because we really don't let a lot of stuff to the brain, and the barrier that we're talking about here is called a blood-brain barrier, and it's created by tight junctions that don't let most stuff go to the brain tissue. So that's in fact why we use that cerebrospinal fluid. It's a way to carry nutrients to the brain tissue, get rid of the waste products from the brain tissue, but it's a way to prevent that blood from taking a direct route to the brain tissue. So I just wanted to mention that. Do notice where the blood-brain barrier is missing from your brain. We don't have it on the hypothalamus or where else? Good, yeah, medulla oblongata. So, do notice that there is no blood-brain barrier over those two special locations. We'll discover in a few pages why those two areas need direct access to your blood. So no blood-brain barrier over the hypothalamus or that medulla oblongata. Okay. So now we're ready to go on to page 112. Let's talk about the four main regions there at the top of your page. The four main regions include the cerebrum, cerebellum, diencephalon, and brainstem. The cerebrum is kind of like a mushroom cap. It's the wrinkly outer portion of our brains, and the cerebellum sits at the back of our brain as a separate piece. Cool thing about this picture, they've allowed us to see the brainstem and diencephalon underneath that cerebrum cap. So you can see what they label here as the forebrain is in fact the diencephalon. That includes the hypothalamus, the thalamus, and even a portion called the pituitary gland. And then down below, heading toward the spinal cord, the pons, medulla, and the midbrain are actually portions of that brainstem. So we kind of can see all the parts here in this picture. You may wonder why the brain itself is wrinkly, and it has to do with storing a large amount of neurons in a small brain size. You know, we actually have pretty big heads, but our head size is limited by the size of mother's pelvic outlet. So if babies are born with really, really big heads, they cannot fit through the pelvic outlet that's created by those coxal bones. So in order to have these powerful, high-processing brains, the brain has to be wrinkly in order to store a lot of information. So it's all about brain size and pelvis size. Being able to be born is important. So that's what we think drives the wrinkliness of the cerebrum. Gives us more surface area and allows us to store more information there. So let me talk you through the cerebrum first. There are some lobes here that are associated with the bone names that you probably already know. All right, so where should we find the frontal lobe? Front, good, right where that frontal bone is located. On each side, you've got the temporal lobes. On the upper side, you've got the parietal lobes, and at the back, you have occipital lobes. Okay, so those four brain regions correspond to the parts of your skull, frontal, temporal, upper top here, parietal on each side, and then back you've got that occipital lobe. So there shouldn't be anything unfamiliar about those four primary sets of lobes around the brain.
Okay, so in terms of functions, you'll notice that the brain is the processing center. This is where we have conscious thought. This is where we integrate thoughts. We make decisions in the cerebrum. Our personality comes from the cerebrum. Thoughts and memory all originate here. So your conscious perception of what it means to be a functional living being comes from that cerebrum. And in fact, the functional part of your cerebrum that gives rise to your existence is in the outer 1/8 inch of that cerebrum. That's crazy. The outer 1/8 inch of your cerebrum is what gives rise to all these conscious thoughts and what it means to be you. So if you take a look at the wrinkly outer portion of the cerebrum here, you'll notice the outer portion is in fact gray matter, while the inner portion is white matter. How does that compare to the spinal cord? Opposite, yeah. So this time we've got gray matter on the outside. Well, we know that gray matter sends nerve impulses more slowly because we're looking at unmyelinated neurons, but this is where we really form a sense of ourselves. This outer 1/8 inch is called the cerebral cortex, and you can imagine it's kind of like the peel of an apple. If you peel off the outer portion of the apple, the colored peel, that's where the thought processes are going on in our brains. Any damage to that cerebral cortex can damage thoughts, memory, it can change personality. So, damages such as bumps to the head, excess swelling of the brain can cause changes in all of those things that we consider to be parts of who we are, how we make ourselves who we are. Okay, so this gray matter here, this outer cerebral cortex, is found all over the entire cerebral cortex surface, and that's where conscious processing and thoughts occur. Okay, so let's talk about the white matter. The white matter is, in fact, inside the brain. You'll notice there's pockets of it deep inside. Like you told me, it's completely opposite to what we expect to see with the spinal cord. Okay, so in terms of the wrinkly portions, let's go back to that picture and talk about a term here, gyrus and sulcus. Okay, and that's up under the gray matter, gyrus and sulcus. What is the difference? Good. Gyrus is a raised hill, sulcus is a valley. If you are sulking, you are down in the dumps, aren't you? Okay, so sulcus is a groove. It sucks down into those valleys. You might think of it that way, but sulcus is to sulk down. I had a student years ago, she said, I got a way to remember this. She said it stuck with her. I'll share it with you. Maybe it will help it stick for you. She said that God was up and Satan was down. The gyri are hills that poke up. The sulci are valleys that poke down. So I thought, hey, G and up and S is down, that works for me. So if that works for you, feel free to use it. But, it's hard to keep those two straight. Okay. So when we're talking about Brodmann's areas, you'll notice that term is next under the gray matter. These are functional areas of the brain, and we're going to talk through some of the most important ones. These are areas that include speech, such as in the left hemisphere, or vision, which is in the occipital lobe. So we're going to locate each of those most important areas, those Brodmann's areas. Let's talk about fiber tracts for just a moment. Fiber tracts are groups of neurons that are in the white matter of our brains. So is white matter superficial or deep? It is deep, good. So there are three main sets of fiber tracts that carry information around your brain. They're called association, commissural, and projection fibers. You've probably heard the old joke that mothers have eyes in the backs of their heads, right? Okay, so everybody's vision is processed in the back of your head. And you wonder, how in the world does what you see out the front actually get carried to the backside? And it's through association fibers. And notice in the top picture here, you're looking at the left hemisphere of the brain, and a set of fibers runs from the front all the way to the back. That's how the vision gets back there. It's through traveling along association fibers. Those association fibers are white matter,
So we're talking fast in terms of nerve impulse transmission. So you've got association fibers traveling from each eye along the entire length of your cerebrum to the back at the occipital lobe, and that's actually where we process vision, is in the backs of our heads. All right, commissural fibers are next. You'll notice down here in this picture, they don't run the length, rather, they run left to right, connecting those two hemispheres. So you have learned in lab, most likely, about the corpus callosum, and that corpus callosum is a great example of commissural fibers that connect the left and the right hemispheres. So in this picture, it's this piece running right through here, kind of like a little cap running around, and that set of fibers connects the two hemispheres, left and right. Have you had a psych class where they've talked about cutting those commissural fibers? Okay, if you haven't, the story goes like this. They have actually, you know, unexpectedly done studies on people that had seizures, and to prevent them from having further seizures, they actually cut those corpus callosum fibers. And in cutting those fibers, they realized, oh, hey, this actually altered the way the brain could perceive information. And so they found that, you know, if you cover up one eye and let the vision go on the other eye, that it's not able to go to the hemisphere that eye belongs to. So what that means is if you cover up the left eye and you look only with your right eye, that right eye information mostly travels to your left hemisphere. How does it get to the right hemisphere? Corpus callosum. So they were actually being able to test people and say, hey, you know, they can't identify objects as what they are. They can't say the name of keys that are laying on their desk because the information is unable to travel across that commissural connection. So that's it. That's the connection between the left and right hemispheres. You've got a couple of sets of commissural fibers, and that's how the information travels between the two hemispheres. Let's see. Our last set of fibers are called projection fibers. And in this picture, you'll notice they're coming up from this area right here called the thalamus, and it looks like they're radiating out toward the cerebral cortex. So projection fibers carry information that's coming up from the spinal cord, hits the thalamus, and then is radiated to the appropriate part of the brain. All right, let's think back to last class period. What kind of information travels to the thalamus? Sensory, good. And specifically, is it muscle information or is it temperature information?
Temperature.
Temperature, good. So pain and temperature go to the thalamus. And the thalamus says, hey, you just burned your hand. I'm going to use projection fiber to send that to the appropriate portion of your brain. So projection fibers carry sensory information from your spinal cord through the thalamus and then out to the appropriate part of your cerebral cortex. Okay. How about questions so far on those three association, projection, and commissural fibers? Do they make sense? Okay.
Can you show me the gyrus and the sulcus?
Gyrus and the sulcus. Let's see. This is a gyrus here. It's a bump or a heel that sticks up. That is a sulcus, kind of a groove down. Now, if it's a really, really deep sulcus, it's called a fissure. But for the most part, what's covering most of our brain is gyri and sulci. Okay. How about any other questions on parts we've covered so far? All right, so instead of looking at page 113, flip over with me to 115. Let's label a picture. Okay, so first of all, we're looking at a hemisphere of the brain, and since you're able to see all of this stuff and on the inside, we're looking at the left hemisphere of the brain. We need to understand front side or anterior from back side or posterior, so I use the cerebellum back here to tell me that I'm looking at the posterior side of the brain. So just kind of like a road map, north and south, I'm going to label A there for anterior, and back here on the other end, P for posterior. All right, so let's go ahead and label the lobes. Where would you place the frontal lobe?
Anterior,
good. So let's place frontal lobe. Temporal lobe, where would you place that one?
On the sides.
On the sides, good. At the back, you have the parietal lobe. What is that?
Occipital,
yeah. That's right, that's what it was. It was a quick test, right? Okay, and up top there would be our parietal lobe. Since we've got a nice side view, why don't we go ahead and label the transverse fissure. That separates cerebrum from what? Cerebellum, good. You can pick out a gyrus and a sulcus and label those. So we'll just find one that looks good. Okay, so here's the thing. We don't have like a real hard line that divides these lobes, except for one location. And there's a really nice deep fissure that separates frontal lobe from parietal lobe. And we can definitively say that's where one lobe ends and the other one begins. So if you notice right through here, it looks like a pretty nice looking fissure. And we're going to use that fissure to say, okay, that is the separating point between the frontal lobe and the parietal lobe. It's not really deep enough to be called a fissure, so instead we're just going to call it a sulcus. And so that little groove there is the separating point. In fact, because it's about the midway portion of your brain, they call it the central sulcus. So let's label that groove right through there. Okay, let's call that groove that central sulcus. Not very deep. Not deep enough to be called a fissure. Now there's a piece of brain tissue in the frontal lobe that sits in front of that central sulcus, and because it's in front, we call it the precentral gyrus. So I've dotted it, made an outline there for you. This area is called our precentral gyrus. And in which lobe do you find that precentral gyrus? Frontal lobe, good, that's in the frontal lobe. page, another dotted outline. That one is the post-central gyrus. Notice it's found behind or posterior to that central sulcus. It is found in the parietal lobe. So far, so good. I'm going to use a different color because those are the anatomical parts of the brain, and I'm going to use a different color to emphasize that we're working on now functional parts of the brain. Why don't we just start back here at the cerebellum? I don't have this on your list, but we're just going to jot it down since it gives you a great study guide. The cerebellum is a place where we house balance and equilibrium. Now, we're going to talk later on that the ear is involved in balance and equilibrium, but your cerebellum is involved in coordinating your balance and your skeletal muscle activities. You know, we all know that when people are drunk, they can't walk straight. That is not necessarily the inner ear that's the problem. It's the cerebellum that's become drunk itself. The proprioceptors in your arms and legs and your joints don't send information, and the cerebellum doesn't coordinate properly. So we think of this as a place where we coordinate balance and equilibrium. Let's put vision in your occipital lobe. Let's put vision in your occipital lobe. We know that the eyes, of course, go to the back of the head. What type of fibers carry that information there? Good. Association carries it to the back of the head. Good. Well, a similar sense is hearing. Let's place hearing in which lobe? Temporal. Good. Let's put hearing in temporal lobe. What an odd combination of senses, but taste and smell are not in the same lobe. They're in fact in separate lobes. But you'll notice that smell is actually in the temporal lobe with hearing. Kind of a strange combination of senses there, but nonetheless, both in temporal lobe. Let's go to the frontal lobe, and the frontal lobe houses personality, decorum, toilet training, knowing when to say something, when not to say something. We've all seen people walking down the street cursing at the world, and you think, who are they talking to? There's no phone in their ear. You know, sometimes people have damage to that frontal lobe, and they no longer can screen what they say. You can have something like chemical damage to the frontal lobe. You can have vascular damage to the frontal lobe, impact that damages it. And even prefrontal lobotomies back in the 1940s to the 1960s damaged people's frontal lobes, and they lost the ability to scream what they say. They lost the ability to do toilet training, bowel continence, things of that sort. So personality, decorum, toilet training, let's put all of that up here in the frontal lobe. Filter, yeah. Decorum, yeah.
Okay, so a couple more things to look at. Let's head to that central sulcus area and look at the pre- and post-central gyrus. The pre-central gyrus is home to motor information. Okay, pre-central gyrus is motor. I want to be specific here. This is voluntary motor control. So what kinds of muscles are being controlled?
Skeletal.
Good. So pre-central gyrus is home to motor control, but let's be specific and say it's voluntary motor control. Okay, and the post-central gyrus is going to be home to something called somatic sensory. And what this means is what you feel through your skin. That can include, say, you know, pain, temperature, touch, pressure. So normally when we hear about our senses, we think about vision, hearing, taste, and smell. But then, of course, there's touch, and that's where we're now at. We're looking at touch and pressure and pain in the skin going up here to that post-central gyrus. Since we're in the neighborhood of the parietal lobe, let's also include taste in the parietal lobe. How you doing with your picture? So far, so good? Okay. So if you would like to print out another one, you can pull one from your course pack. This PowerPoint has not only this picture, but there's also a labeled one if you want to double check yourself. So the picture right before this one in the PowerPoint has a labeled, all the parts labeled for you. What I'd like to do now is now go back to page 113 and work you through the material. If you've got a three-ring binder where you can pop out the picture, you may want to lay it side by side so you can reference where everything is located as we work our way through. Y'all have any questions so far? Wrong. Okay. So don't let page 113 intimidate you. I would not sit there and try to memorize that page. What I would do is get myself a picture of a brain and do just what we did. Take the list of labels, label all the structures, and then talk myself through what each part is responsible for doing. I think you'll find that that's way less intimidating and way easier than working yourself through the chart. Let's start with one area we've just discovered, and that is the voluntary motor control there on the top of your page. We know that voluntary motor control comes from this region here in the frontal lobe called the precentral gyrus. So we call it the precentral gyrus because it is a hill of raised tissue sitting in front of that central sulcus right through there. So that voluntary motor control actually has a map, which is really cool. This map is called a motor homunculus, and you'll notice it's mapped to every part of your body. So you can see a lot of the surface area is devoted to your face, a lot to your hands and feet, but very little motor control is devoted to your elbows and knees because only they open and they close, right? So there doesn't need to be a whole lot of fancy motor control going to those particular areas. So the motor homunculus is on each hemisphere of your brain. You have one on the right hemisphere that is mapped to which side of your body? Left side, good. And you have a motor homunculus on your left hemisphere that's mapped to the right side of your body. What do we call that type of control?
contralateral.
Yeah.
That is called contralateral control. Okay? So, interesting thing here about the way this is set up, your brain is hardwired to have all your body parts. Okay? And if you lose a body part, your brain still thinks it's there. So, you know, last class period we talked about phantom limb pain and retraining your brain to recognize parts that are gone. So you're literally having to train those brain parts to say, okay, I recognize I'm no longer to be recognizing a foot that's no longer part of my body. So yeah, you're hardwired to have all the body parts, even if they're not present, even from birth. Okay. So just to kind of link all this together, I know this is a rather busy picture, but when you decide that you're going to move a body part, the control initiates in an area called the primary motor cortex on the correct hemisphere of your brain. So if I want to move my left hand, which side of my brain initiates that control?
Right side.
Right side. Yep. So right side tells my left hand to move. Notice that that comes from that motor homunculus in the precentral gyrus of the frontal lobe. We travel down a set of tracks in the white matter. Should we use descending or ascending tracks?
Descending,
right, because we're going down the spinal cord. Notice right there, we go across the gray commissure. Finally, way down here at the bottom, we're going to travel out the appropriate horn of gray matter, the one that controls voluntary skeletal muscles. Should that be the lateral horn or the ventral horn? It's hard to see there, but it is the ventral horn, right? And that sends voluntary motor control out that ventral root. We join the spinal nerve, and that nerve impulse then travels out to the body part and says, okay, we want you to move. And so the nerve impulse releases acetylcholine, and that body part moves. So to kind of link it together, we travel from the cerebral cortex down descending tracks, across the gray commissure, and ultimately out the appropriate horn of the gray matter, and then out of spinal nerve to your destination. So, you know, it takes a split second for this message to travel, but, you know, it's a pretty fast route since we're traveling down white matter. Those tracks are white matter. Okay. How about questions so far on voluntary motor control? Obviously, if they're damaged, you know, if that motor homunculus has any damage, you can't move. So if someone is hit across the top of the head, then that translates to not being able to move certain body parts or even all body parts. So it translates all the way down to the rest of that motor control. The next piece I want to point out to you is a set of gray matter deep within your brain that are called basal nuclei. These basal nuclei are situated right about there. They look almost like little eyeballs inside the brain. And they are responsible for subconscious motor control. So you may notice that when you walk, you swing your arms side by side. You don't have to think about it. You don't even have to control this motion. But that is a subconscious movement that's controlled by the basal nuclei, not by those voluntary motor cortexes up there in the frontal lobe. So you've probably seen people with Parkinson's disease. People with Parkinson's have low levels of a neurotransmitter called dopamine. When they walk, they don't swing their arms. In fact, how do they walk? They shuffle. Yeah, they shuffle. Their arms kind of hang by their side or a little bit in the front. You've probably seen older people do this who have Parkinson's disease. And that's because the lack of dopamine means that those nuclei here no longer control that automatic arm swing that we do when we're walking. So, in fact, dopamine is important for those neurotransmitters to carry information back and forth in those basal nuclei. So interesting stuff about how we can determine, you know, what kind of disorder somebody may have just by watching them move. Now we know that Parkinson's is related to that lack of dopamine. Okay, how about questions so far on motor control that's voluntary and subconscious? Where in what lobe specifically is somatic sensory information taken? Parietal, good. What specific part of the parietal lobe? Postcentral gyrus, good. So you'll notice that in this postcentral gyrus, the job here is to receive and interpret incoming somatic sensory information. This is what's coming from your skin. And it's not coming from your eyes, ears, mouth, or nose. This is all somatic or body information. So the somatic sensory area is like other sensory areas. Let me explain the difference between a primary and an association area. All of our sensory inputs have a primary that primarily receives the information. It receives it first. The association area then makes sense of it. It interprets that information, or it associates it with something that you recognize. So let me put it to you this way. If you put your hand in your pocket, if you've got pockets, and you feel around in there for something, you may notice keys, you may notice coins, but simply feeling those objects is primary somatic sensation. When you say, I think that's a key, you know, you feel the shape of it, you say, I think that feels like a key, now you're using your association area to make sense of it, okay? So if all you feel is cold metal objects and you haven't yet identified what they are, that is the primary somatic sensory receiving the info. The association area has to make sense for you. People can have damage in one or both places. So if they can feel things but not understand what they're touching, that would be a damage in which specific region? They can feel but don't understand. Yeah, that'd be damage to the association area, right? If they can't feel, where's the damage done to the brain? Primary, yeah, so the primary area would have that damage. So let's map this once again. We have a sensory homunculus once again that is gonna receive sensory info from your body. Same concept, right side of your hemisphere of the brain gets information from the left side of your body and vice versa. So your left hand is mapped to your right cerebrum on that postcentral gyrus. So even if you don't have arms and legs, you still have a mental brain map to those body parts. I mentioned to you a while back about, you know, all these issues with phantom limb pain. Back in the 1960s, they thought they had discovered a drug that could be greatly used for morning sickness in pregnant women. And unfortunately, it caused birth defects where body parts didn't develop. The United States actually never approved the drug. Other countries in Europe were using the drug for other purposes, and those countries were actually saying, hey, you know, this might be great for morning sickness. So a lot of pregnant ladies were given thalidomide as a way to treat morning illness. Well, in this country, they said, show us the proof. Where's the proof that thalidomide actually works? And thankfully, did not ever approve the drug for that particular use. And that was kind of the birth of drug testing back in the early 1960s. So the FDA had a woman in charge that was saying, hey, give us some information that says this is an effective drug for morning sickness. Since they could not, you know, it was not ever approved for that use here. Nowadays, it's actually used for some cancer purposes, so it does have use, just not for the intended use back in that time period. The point is, even for these people born like this person here with very shortened arms and legs, their somatic sensory cortex is still mapping that entire body part. So their brains have a sensory homunculus and a motor homunculus that is there for body parts had they grown. So kind of interesting that the brain was ready, the body parts just didn't produce. All right, so let me get you to this picture we were looking at before. So the same way that information travels down the spinal cord, information can travel up the spinal cord. So what type of tract takes information up the spinal cord?
Ascending.
Ascending, right. So when you send something, those ascending tracts take the information across to the appropriate hemisphere and map it to that sensory homunculus. Okay, let's talk visual. In which lobe is vision housed?
Occipital,
good. What type of fiber takes that information from your eyes along the hemisphere to the back of your brain?
Association,
good. So these association fibers are gonna carry visual information to your occipital lobe, first to a primary visual cortex, and then second to an association area. So what happens at the primary visual cortex? You see, good. What happens at the association area?
You make out what you see.
Good. You make out what you see, you understand it, you interpret it. So, you know, sometimes when you wake up in the middle of the night, you're groggy, and you can see, right?
but you have no idea what's going on. You can't interpret what's happening. You can't interpret what you see. Kind of think of that as what the association does for the visual cortex. It lets you make sense of things. It lets you recognize what you're seeing. So I do want to emphasize that if you have an issue where there's a stroke or brain damage to the primary visual cortex, what happens to that person's vision? It's gone, right? If you damage that primary visual cortex, you are now blind and cannot see. What if you have an intact primary visual cortex, but you have damage to the association area? You'd be groggy, yeah. You can see, you just don't understand what you're seeing, right? So you may know people who have had strokes. They can see, they just don't recognize people. So family members they've known their entire lives now look like strangers. They just look like any other person that enters their room. So the interpretation occurs in that association area. This is a really cool thing that's been going on for about the past 10 years. There's some research that's been going on for people who have lost their vision, and they're using these really fancy glasses. Not the glasses, they're not seeing, but the glasses have cameras on them that allow that person to get vision into their occipital lobe. So you'll notice that they've got cameras that scan the image that they should be seeing, and there are cables at the back that can plug that information into your occipital lobe. So it works best if you were able to see at some point in your life. Okay? So they had an experiment. They had couple of people involved, and two stood out. They had a woman in her 20s who had seen up until age 3. At age 3, due to some kind of disease, she lost her vision, but she had been able to see for at least 3 years. They also had a man in his 40s, blind from the first day of life, never had seen anything. Who do you think really enjoyed wearing the glasses? The girl in her 20s, yeah. Why do you think she really enjoyed the glasses? She had seen before, good. What particular part of her occipital lobe had developed? Association area, yeah. So what she saw was kind of an outline of her mom, and she says, ooh, I want to use these again because maybe her brain will eventually further develop interpreting those images. So the girl in her 20s was all about continuing the experiment. She was thrilled to be able to see a little bit of her mom again. Man in the 40s, what did he say about it?
Didn't work.
Didn't work. Take these off. I'm done. Don't want them anymore. Why do you think that was the case for him? He had never seen before, and that association area says, what is this stuff, right? 40-something years, and it had never had to associate images. And so we learn, because we can see, to filter out unnecessary information. You ignore the ceiling, you ignore the floor, you ignore a lot of the visual information coming into your brain. There is actually a filter in your thalamus that keeps out unnecessary information. Well, that man in his 40s who had been given these glasses never learned to filter, and his association area had never learned to associate what he was seeing. So for him, it was unfortunately overwhelming. So what does that tell us about babies born who are blind? What should we do from as early as we can? Hook them up with this, right? Because if they ever have a chance to see, they got to get that association area to work.
When is your brain fully developed?
Age
25. Well, I mean, so his is already developed.
His is already developed.
So she would definitely have a bigger chance.
Yeah.
Even if she wasn't born with sight, right?
Right. And some stuff develops earlier and faster and matures more so than others, but you're right, by age 25, her brain plasticity was still there, but his was not. There's cool stuff out there. All right, let's talk about hearing. In which lobe is hearing housed?
Temporal
lobe, good. What does the primary auditory cortex do?
It hears.
It hears, yeah, it gets sound. What does the association area do?
Interpret
sound, right. Imagine a person who had a stroke in the association area of the temporal lobe. This man answers the telephone, and he doesn't know who's on the other end. And his daughter, he's known for her entire life, is on the other end of the line.
but he doesn't interpret the voice as being hers. So that's kind of what goes on with that association area if you receive damage. You can't recognize sounds, you know, and so we can't interpret what we hear in that association area if we receive damage. All right, so we've talked about smell and taste. They are oddly not in the same particular lobe, but you'll notice that smell is in the temporal lobe and taste is in the parietal lobe. So even though they're very related to one another, they're in different lobes of the brain. All right, how about questions so far? Do you feel more or less comfortable with what we've covered so far? Okay. Just a couple more things here on the bottom of your page in terms of general interpretation. You'll notice it's normally housed in the left hemisphere of your brain. A lot of your senses end up getting sent here so that we have a holistic experience. You know, you've probably heard the statement that we don't live by one sense alone. So what you see, hear, smell, taste, and touch ends up getting routed to this general interpretive area, and that is where we can end up putting all of these senses together as a holistic experience. Another interesting thing is speech. It's for most of us housed in the left hemisphere. Have a real low-tech experiment to run in here with you today. How many of you are right-handed? Wow, anybody left-handed? Just a couple of you. Okay, so I'm interested for those of us who talk with our phones on the right-hand side of our brain, if you're right-handed, how many of you do that?
Put it to the right ear.
Put it to the right ear, yeah. If you're right-handed, this is me, I cannot hear out of my left ear if I put my phone to that ear. Any of you experience that? Okay, for my lefties, which ear do you talk on? Either one, or do you prefer an ear? Either one? Okay, interesting. So for those who are right-handed and prefer your right ear for the telephone, guess where your speech center is probably housed? Left side, yeah. For those of you who may prefer either ear, you know, it could be on the right side. For most of us, it's on the left side. And I've had students who say, no, I talk only on my left ear, and they're gonna have that speech center most likely where? On the right side, yeah. So kind of an interesting thing there, a low-tech experiment, may or may not be entirely accurate, but it seems to run the case that most of us have that speech center on the left side and do prefer talking on the telephone on the right side if it's, you know, set up in that way. Okay. Prefrontal cortex, we've talked a little bit about. I do want to share an interesting story with you. So this man was working on the railroad back in the 1840s, and there was an explosion that blew a railroad spike through his eye and his brain. His name was Phineas Gage, and lo and behold, they pulled the spike out of his eye and his brain, and he lived. So, unbelievable story that back in that time period, they were able to save this guy's life. You can see that he lost his eye over here on this left side. If you read about his life, he was a happy-go-lucky, you know, great personality kind of guy up until this explosion shot the spike through his head. I think I'd be angry, too, if I had a railroad spike shot through my head. And his personality changed greatly. You can see in the image over here, they've used his skull to kind of recreate where that spike was creating damage. Notice which lobe it poked through. Frontal lobe, yeah. So why do you think he had a personality change after the spike? That's where it's housed, yeah. So they say that he became very angry. He was violent. He didn't have a happy life. I think he lived some 20 or 30 years after this accident occurred. But he didn't have a happy life after this. And he was kind of the cornerstone for us realizing that the frontal lobe is where we house things like personality. And if damaged, it can cause great changes to the body's, the mind's personality. You may have also heard of prefrontal lobotomies, something that was done back in the 40s to the 60s. They used something similar to an ice pick. They ran it back through the fissures behind the eyes into the brain. And it was used for people who had personality disorders like bipolar disorder and, you know, schizophrenia and things of that sort. Back in that time period, there was a couple of doctors that said, hey, if we kind of damage that prefrontal cortex, we can change the personality, and your violent teenager can now become a docile teenager. So there was something between, I don't know, 40 to 60,000 people that took their kids to these doctors and had prefrontal lobotomies performed. Well, in addition to personality changes, what else happened to them? Toilet training. Yeah, so they lost their ability to be continent. They couldn't hold their urine or their feces. They became in a vegetative state. And there was one person who had a prefrontal lobotomy done, and it was Rosemary Kennedy. You might recall that President Kennedy was in office back in the early 1960s. I believe it was his sister that had a prefrontal lobotomy performed. She became in a vegetative state afterwards, and their family developed the Special Olympics because of her. So finally, in the mid-1960s, they put a stop to these prefrontal lobotomies. They were not a solution to mental disorders like bipolar. We know nowadays it's a chemical imbalance, but back then they thought, some doctors thought that that was a way to get this particular disorder solved. But unfortunately, they were not able to take the guy's medical license away. He continued to practice for some 20 years that was performing those prefrontal lobotomies. So another case of saying, hey, this is what happens to that prefrontal cortex if damaged. Just a little bit there on the bottom there, lateralization. Okay, so the left hemisphere, they say, is classically for things like reading and writing. And they say the right hemisphere is for things like visual and spatial skills. We oftentimes associate math and science skills with that left hemisphere. Now, we don't live by one hemisphere alone. We actually use both hemispheres more or less equally. But, you know, if you tend to favor a particular subject, like if you really love science, or perhaps if you really love art, then you may actually favor working on one hemisphere versus the other. Interesting thing about those hemispheres, up until the mid-teenage years, if a child has, say, really horrible seizures, one hemisphere can be removed and the other hemisphere can learn to compensate for the missing hemisphere. So really interesting, after the mid-teenage years, we no longer have that type of brain plasticity. And so, you know, if you do that to somebody who's age 30, you're going to cause massive damage to the way they operate. But kind of interesting that the brain is so flexible up until the middle teenage years. Okay, so that is a huge page of information. What kind of questions do you have so far? I would, and once you start working through them, you'll know them automatically, because it's just, if it doesn't work, you can't do it. Let me emphasize again that I would print extra pictures and label them. I think that's probably the best way to get this to stick, especially if you're a visual learner. Rather than sitting there and trying to make flashcards out of that page, talk yourself through a picture. All right, so page 114 is some practice on that info. You can get all the answers from page 113. And we did page 115. Let me tell you about page 116. I have bold-faced the important parts of the page. So if you look at cerebellum, you'll notice one of the important functions is muscle coordination. Those are clue words to look for come test time. If you scan down to the hypothalamus, you'll notice that I've bolded the word homeostasis, another clue word to look for. Thalamus is a relay station. Pituitary gland works on endocrine function. The medulla has four centers: cardiovascular, respiratory, emetic is vomiting, and vasomotor. The pons is for breathing, and the midbrain is a reflex center.
Thank you.
That's a lot easier than having to read that whole page, right?
Thank you very much.
That's the main thing you need to know. So now that we've done the highlight tour and the need-to-know information, let me just kind of walk you through these. We'll start back up there at the cerebellum. It is on the back of your brain. And really cool thing about the cerebellum, if you look at a bird brain, you know, we think bird brains are puny and tiny, right? And they are. They're in these little teeny tiny skulls. But if you look at a bird brain, they're almost all cerebellum. Why?
Flied, yeah. You know, every now and again, they fly into something stupid like your windshield or a window, right? Not their fault. That's transparent. They probably didn't see it. But, you know, birds can maneuver greatly around things. You know, imagine being able to fly and land and navigate. So that cerebellum is the important portion for your muscle coordination, balance, and equilibrium. We're going to learn in the last chapter in this course about the relationship between the ear and the cerebellum, because all of that is linked together. And there's a cool little homunculus in there that is mapped to your body's parts, so it allows for you to coordinate your body's movements. The diencephalon includes three parts: thalamus, hypothalamus, and pituitary gland. So we've already talked about the thalamus. We know it's a portion of the brain that's a relay station for incoming sensory info. What specific type of sensory information? Pain and temperature, yeah. Thalamus especially transmits pain and temperature information to your brain. So some cool stuff about your thalamus. If you're awake, so is your thalamus. If you're not awake, your thalamus is asleep too. So your thalamus is part of what keeps you awake and alert. When you go to sleep, you have to put your thalamus to sleep. If you're constantly stimulated, you know, with, you know, conversation, noise, lights, all this stuff, your thalamus is constantly relaying information up to your brain. So that's why most of us have to have a quiet environment to sleep in, because if you're constantly staying stimulated, your thalamus is going to stay awake with you as well. So the thalamus in this picture is right about there. And you're going to think I'm crazy, but there's a duck in your brain. I'm going to show you where the duck is. So this is the duck's head, and there's the duck's beak. The head is the thalamus. The beak is partly the hypothalamus, and there's where the pituitary gland is going to hang from that infundibulum. Right here is the duck's neck. This is the duck's chest sticking out. That's the pons sticking out. And right behind the duck's neck is the midbrain, okay? And then this particular duck is wearing a big crest on its head. And this big crest is right here. It is what? Corpus callosum, right. So if you kind of use your imagination, you can use the duck and the brain as a way to kind of maneuver your way around all this diencephalon area. So diencephalon is thalamus, which is your sensory relay station, hypothalamus, which is the home for your homeostasis control, and the pituitary gland, which actually has been cut out of this brain in this picture. Let's talk about hypothalamus since we're also looking at the diencephalon. What is the major function here?
Homeostasis,
good. So it controls hunger, thirst, okay, all these things that are, you know, really primal survival issues. It also controls body temperature, food intake, you know, sleep and wake cycles. So basically being able to survive and exist is going to be housed here in your hypothalamus. Just want to mention something interesting. Certain medications like ecstasy, not that that's a medication, right? That's not really I got to go home and take my ecstasy to go to sleep, right? No, not the case. But, you know, drugs like ecstasy actually reset your hypothalamus's body temperature center higher than normal. And in some people, it can reset your body temp up to 104, 106. You will die at 108. So, you know, there have been stories of people taking ecstasy, resetting their body temperatures higher, and, like, burning up with fever from having taken that drug. So, kind of scary stuff when you think about it. Yeah, right, right. Because your hypothalamus says, this is the set temperature that I want you to be at, and then your metabolism and whatnot runs at that rate to maintain that heat.
Wow.
Yeah, that's some scary stuff.
Yeah, so at
108,
you'll die.
108, you'll die. It denatures your proteins, and it basically cooks you like an egg.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's see, let's go back and find a picture of the, I don't know if I've got a good one of the pituitary, let's see. Yeah, that's a good one there. Kind of a strange looking little gland. It sits in the cella turcica. Its major function is endocrine control. That is all I'm going to say about it, because when you guys start Bio-211, that is going to be the first 3 weeks of Bio-211. So I don't want to spoil the fun that's going to wait you around the corner. We'll explore all about the pituitary gland in 211. Yeah. Let's see, brainstem includes three parts, medulla, pons, and midbrain. Okay, so let's hit the medulla first. It has several control centers, and this is also going to be greatly explored in Bio-211. We have the cardiovascular center here that controls heart rate. We have a vasomotor center controlling blood pressure. The respiratory center controls breathing, and an emetic center that controls vomiting. Ah, this has no blood-brain barrier, right? So if you ate something off of a buffet that was not kept at the proper temperature, we've all been there, right? Okay, and you went home sick like a dog, that's because you need to know if that poison's in your system. Once that food is absorbed into your bloodstream, it circulates past your medulla. Your medulla says, ooh, that's poison with bacteria, and it makes you vomit. So very good reason to have no blood-brain barrier here. We are monitoring blood chemistry, what poisons may be in your bloodstream, and other stuff like that. That is also the same reason the hypothalamus has no blood-brain barrier. Okay. Pons is the breathing portion of your brain. It sets a pace for respiration. That is something we'll also talk about in great detail in Bio-211. And what a strange looking piece here. The midbrain is actually formed from four little bumps on the backside. You can probably see them right there. And because they look like little bumps like baby's butts, they call them the Corpora Quadrigemina. Literally translated, it means the body of the four twins. And I know what you think that looks like, right? So kind of a strange looking piece here for the brain stem, but in fact, that's the pons. Well, thalamus up there, and then you've got the pons down below, medulla below that, and you'll notice all these cranial nerves branching off of this brain stem. So since this is a control center for a lot of these automatic responses, no wonder those cranial nerves are gonna branch off that area. So the midbrain at the very bottom of your page is a reflex center. You know, your ear and your eye are closely related to what they are interpreting. If you've ever ridden in a car or a boat and been seasick, that is part of that reflex center that goes through your midbrain. So eye and ear reflexes are housed through that midbrain. Let's see, we don't have a lot to finish here. We can leave page 117 for Monday. And that's the limbic and reticular system. Let's plan Monday to work on autonomic nervous systems. If you want to read ahead, we're going no further than page 125 for our test 4. Okay, no further than 125. Y'all have a good weekend. I'll see you Monday.